All right. Last time we were able to begin the well-known 11th chapter of Hebrews. Some have called it the Hall of Faith or other such things. But what we saw there was the beginning with the overture of the nature of faith. Let me just read again the first bit of that. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, for by it the men of old gained approval. Now, we'll see these ideas, the idea of hope, the idea of faith, obviously, and the idea of it being related to things not seen over and over and over again as we go through these by faith statements that the author of Hebrews gives us. Last time we were able to go through the antediluvians, or those up to the time of Noah, and begin the patriarchal period. We got as far as looking at the first instance of description of Abraham's faith in verses 8 through 12. But just remember, because they will come up again, that he begins his hall of faith with Abel, and he will come up again in the future. He ends this this first antediluvian section with Noah, and it's interesting that Noah gives us an illustration of something that I was going to make a point of later, but because of the sermon this morning, I'll make that point now. First of all, notice how when you see verse 7, by faith Noah being warned about things not yet seen, that is a tie straight back to the overture on faith of it being the conviction of things not seen. So it's an illustration of that. It's not the only time that the author of Hebrews will do that, but again, his rhetorical skill is seen there. The other thing that we see here is there's nothing but praise here for the faith of Noah. And yet we cannot hear the sermon today and understand that Noah, just like every single other person in this chapter, failed in their faith just as much as they excelled in their faith. And that is hope for all of us when we question the faith and our own personal faith. So as we go through these examples, yes, let us see what the author of Hebrews is doing in showing us that even in the old dispensation, the people of faith who got it and the believing in God and the having faith, and because of that lived according to it and then were rewarded by God because of it, they are no more saintly than we are today when we fail in our faith, because they failed in theirs as well. We talked about and began talking about Abraham, who we saw obeyed by going out to a place, not to a land. We often think of Abraham as being called to a land of promise, and he was. And it's referred to a land of promise when he was living as an alien in it. But he's called to a place, and then in verse 10, we're told that as he is called to a place, what he was really looking for was the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. So his view was not just on a land in the Fertile Crescent, but was on a city whose foundations were laid by the architect and builder, who is God. We see in Sarah also that same example of one who begins not having faith, but comes to faith, according to the author of Hebrews. And then, again, we'll see that over and over again. Well, what we will see the author of Hebrews doing next in verses, and we'll pick up with this in verse 13 today, is summarizing or giving a summarizing commentary on that. Let's read verses 13 through 16. All these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them. Remember? Faith is conviction of things not seen. Right? Having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they'd been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better one, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. That city that has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. So we see him beginning by saying, now these all, in his summary, these all died in faith. Now, who are these all? It's a question mark there. Who are these?
Abraham, oh. Sarah, Isaac, and Jacob there.
Probably, yes. Why?
Because that's what comes right before those words.
It does. Why else? Well, let me ask you something. Did Enoch die not having seen the promises, not without receiving the promises? Did he die in faith?
No.
He didn't die at all as far as the scripture goes, did he? So that's the first reason we can say, okay, he's talking about the patriarchal. These he's just talked about. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and Jacob has been included with them. He'll mention them again. The other thing is, if you notice that the context of these verses here, this in this summarizing statement, is sort of a travel motif. Going to a place, seeking a country, and that travel motif doesn't fit Noah and those before him as it does Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob. So there's a couple of reasons to see this. All these died in faith is referring just to those that we've talked about so far in the patriarchal period. Then in verse 17, he will resume by faith Abraham. So he hasn't left them yet. So again, both what comes before, what comes after, and the description during all point to the fact that he's talking about these of the patriarchal period. Notice that he describes them as not seeking a country on earth, whether it be Canaan or Ur, talk about going back from which they came, but a better one and a heavenly one. And because in their faith they saw the things not seen of the promises of God, which center not here on earth, but in heaven, this heavenly city that we talked about, because of their hopeful faith, God is pleased to call them God. This idea of God's pleasure will come up over and over again in this chapter. He's pleased to be called their God, and therefore has prepared for them a heavenly city. We then move on to Abraham part two, where we see the singular demonstration of his faith, the most singular demonstration of his faith in the offering of his son. Verse 17 following. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, "In Isaac your descendants shall be called." He considered that God is able to raise him even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. Well, let's stop right there and unpack that a little bit. You know this story, you know it very well. Abraham's is here, we're told that he was tested in this to offer up his son Isaac. Now Abraham had a problem here. And the problem was, God has promised me that my seed, my heirs would be through Isaac. Now he's asking me to sacrifice him. Now, Abraham considered this problem to be not his problem, but God's problem. You see that? And we need to all take that perspective so oftentimes. When we're going through hardships, this ain't my problem. This is God's problem. And God, if I'm faithful to him, he's going to work this out. How do we know that? All things according to the counsel of his will, and he works all things for good for those who love him and are called. So therefore, when Abraham sees this problem, he says, "All right, God, this is your problem. And I know you can bring him back from the dead." Now, is there any hint that of why the author of Hebrews would say that Abraham knew that God could bring him back from the dead? The Genesis story doesn't really say that. It kind of hints at that. Who has Genesis 22:5? Is that you, Dave?
Oh, I'm sorry. I did. Asleep over here, Pat.
Genesis 22:5.
Then Abraham said to his young man, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you."
All right. So Abraham, at that point, understands that somehow God's going to solve his problem. Because he says to the servants, "We're going to come back to you. Not just me, but I and the boy are going to come back to you." So Abraham's faith was focused on the promises of God, and especially the promise of Isaac as his chosen seed. He also describes it, the author of Hebrews does, as receiving him back as a type. Now, oftentimes we describe this type as being a type of the resurrection of Christ. And that could be there, but I think better if we see Isaac as representing the chosen, the elect, that this is better to be seen as a resurrection of the elect, of the chosen. And then it becomes pointing to that heavenly resurrection that we all are expecting at the end of time, and not merely the resurrection of Christ. Now, I don't like to take an either or on this one. Commentators typically take an either or on that. Either it's a type of Christ's resurrection or a type of the resurrection of the elect. I take a both and. And it's a typical way that prophecy does things. There is a both, the Messiah's coming, and he came in Bethlehem. But there's also the Messiah's coming, and he is coming, as we know, at the end of time. So the both and of the type that I see is, yes, it's a type of the resurrection of the elect one, the chosen one, the, better to say, only begotten, as Isaac was, and also of those of us who are sons through him, those of us who are elect through him. So he receives him back as a type, we are told here. So he goes on then and talks about Isaac and Jacob again, but he includes a third one. I am at verse 20. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. Now, don't miss out the things to come as being an example of things not seen. You remember how last time we talked about things not seen are not seen for two reasons. One, they're in the supernatural world, i.e. heavenly things. Two, they're things in the future. Both of those are things not seen. Here, Isaac blesses Jacob and Esau regarding the things to come. And by faith, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. And by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave order concerning his bones. Now, the key here to seeing how all of these are examples by faith is that phrase, the things to come. Isaac blesses Jacob and Esau regarding the things to come because there are things that are in the future. The future of Jacob and Esau. Now, you remember Jacob got the blessing, but Esau also received a blessing, even though it wasn't as great as the blessing of Jacob. But he blessed him because he depended upon God and believed in God to carry out this this promise of his for his children. Same way, Jacob blesses the children of Joseph because he sees the future and the importance of those two tribes, and especially the one tribe, Ephraim, whom he blessed above Manasseh. He sees the future of them in the history of Israel. And Ephraim was really the predominant tribe of Israel until when?
Until Syria wiped them out.
No, the predominant switches before that some. Until David. Because David is the son of whom?
Jesse.
David is a son of?
Jesse. Judah.
Judah, thank you. The tribe. We're talking tribe now, okay? Of Judah. So the tribe of Judah, which we are told by Jacob will be the predominant tribe, doesn't become that until David. And David wasn't the first king, remember? First king came from which tribe?
Benjamin.
Benjamin. So anyway, Ephraim then, and the importance of that, we see being an example of how God has promised Jacob through the sons of Joseph, and it is fulfilled. His faith sees the things not seen in the things that are to come. Similarly, Joseph, understanding that God has promised that after four generations, the people will return to the Holy Land, says, when you go, take my bones. Actually, it's probably my mummy. Because if you read it in Genesis, you read the way that the Egyptians prepared his body, it's probably describing them mummifying his body. But anyway, the important thing here is that each of these saw the promises of God for the future, and that is what they placed their faith in. Their faith in the God of promise. Now, he goes on from the patriarchal period and goes through a period from the time of the Exodus to the time of entrance into Canaan. Let me read verses 23 through 28. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Notice that the first by faith of Moses is not by faith of Moses, but of his parents. Okay. Then it goes on and says, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. For he was looking for to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who was unseen. Things not seen. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. So here we have Moses, the second great man of God to the Jewish people and really to us in terms of our Old Testament understanding. The first by faith is by the faith of his parents. You know the story very well. Some would say that their faith was weakened when they actually put him in the water because they didn't want to be caught with him. But we don't have any evidence from either the story in Exodus or in what the author of Hebrews has to say about him that was a belittling of their faith. It could have been an act of faith in God that he would take care of him. Now, this phrase, because he was a beautiful child, many have taken that to say that they saw when they saw this baby that there was something special about him and God was going to use him. Raise your hand if you're a parent that if you've ever seen a baby that you didn't think was the greatest thing in the world. So I don't know that this, and that phrase or description comes from Exodus, so I don't know that that phrase is telling us that they understood that God was promising something through this baby from the time he was born. But it was an act of faith that we're told by the author of Hebrews that they did what they did, not being afraid of the king's edict.
Steve,
yes?
To me, I saw the faith part about putting a basket into the Nile River. I mean, Nile River wasn't a meandering little stream creek.
Depending on the time of year, yeah.
It was a river.
And they kept their daughter watching, as if they were thinking something was going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I happen to, I like to kind of figure these things out. So what I'm getting ready to say is not scriptural. It's a human reasoning. They knew where Pharaoh's daughter bathed, and so therefore. But anyway, they didn't know that Pharaoh's daughter would want a baby. But anyway, so whatever it was, they're described as people of faith, as is Moses. Now, the first act of Moses by faith is his identifying with the people of God, rather than what? With the Pharaoh and keeping those. And it's described here as, he had the opportunity to be, to take the treasures of Egypt, the pleasures of Egypt, or to identify with the slavery people. And he chose to identify with them, giving up the pleasures of the treasure and the advantage of being the grandson of Pharaoh, perhaps in line for the throne. Probably not, but perhaps. Now, the phrase he was preferring the reproach of Christ is one that commentators love to debate about. What does it mean that he preferred the reproach of Christ? Well, first of all, we ought not to minimize the awareness of the revelation of God's plan to his Old Testament saints. Moses was fully aware of a coming one. Who has the Deuteronomy 18 passage? Deuteronomy 18, verses 15, I think 18 and 19.
18:15, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen. You shall listen to him. And then 18 and 19, I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. It shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him.
All right, now, what we don't know, we do know that Moses understood there was a coming one. What we don't know is the timing of when he became aware of that and the extent that he had of that knowledge. But Jesus himself cements our understanding that Moses had such knowledge when he said, if you believed, talking to the leaders of the Jews, if you believed in Moses, you would believe in me because he wrote of me. He also, not just Moses, but he also said, Abraham rejoiced to see my day. So the Old Testament saints, let us not minimize the awareness that they had of God's plan for the future. We can't say specifically how much they understood of it, but let us not minimize it. The other thing I want to say about preferring the reproach of Christ is that if we think about what the author of Hebrews has been doing all along and given these warnings that he gives, and understanding that there's probably the idea of wanting to in some way return to the Jewishness of their previous Jewish faith, if this is some Jewish Christians, because of the reproach of Christ that they're getting from their fellow Jews, perhaps, then we see this statement here about Moses being very applicable to the initial readers of this. Importantly, I think that as we've seen before, author of Hebrews here is again showing us an example of how he sees the unity of God's people, Old Testament and New Testament, as we work through this thing. Now, notice the next thing he says about him, that by faith he left Egypt not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who was unseen. Here's the next source of debate. Which leaving of Egypt is the author of Hebrews speaking of here? He left Egypt twice. When were they?
After the murder.
Okay.
And then Exodus.
All right. Now, when does it seem most obvious that he left Egypt not fearing the wrath of the king?
Second time.
I'd say the first.
So he left not fearing the wrath of the king the first one?
No. He wouldn't have left if he had not feared the wrath. Yeah.
Okay, so which one did he leave not fearing?
The second.
All right. Now, the problem with that is what? Look at how he is constructing the description of Moses. By faith, his parents. By faith, he chose not to be called Pharaoh's son. By faith, he left Egypt. By faith, he kept the Passover. Now, which leaving comes between the identifying with the people and the Passover? Does the Exodus come before the Passover? No. So, and again, all of Hebrews is a very careful writer, and it seems to be what he is pointing to is something happening before the event of the Passover. Now, we can't be dogmatic about this. At least I won't be dogmatic about it. But who has Exodus 2:14 and 15? All right.
But he said, who made you a prince or a judge over us?
Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? And Moses was afraid and said, surely the matter has become known. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well.
All right. Fear of Moses is mentioned when? At the king's edict of his death, or at the threat of the fellow Jew to him? The fear is attached to the revelation by the fellow Jew. You're going to kill me too? And then he feared that. Then we have the king's edict, and he fled. Now, so there's some who would say that he didn't really fear the king then. He fled, just as when Jesus was about to be stoned by some, he what? Walked through the cloud and wasn't there, that crowd, and wasn't there anymore. Did that mean he was afraid of the stones? He knew it wasn't God's time. And if Moses understood his calling from God and knew it wasn't God's time, for him to flee from Pharaoh was exactly the right thing to do. Now, again, I don't think we need to fall back on any of these types of understandings. If we understand that just as Noah never had perfect faith, and as Sarah never had perfect faith, Moses didn't ever have perfect faith. But by faith, he did what God called him to do. Secondly, we need to understand that fear is not in opposition to faith. You can have fear and have faith. In fact, it is having faith in fear that is really faith. So if you don't fear, it doesn't take much faith to stand up to something. It is when you fear that you have to trust in God. So him fearing the Pharaoh doesn't mean that he didn't have faith. And him leaving doesn't mean that he had fear. So again, what we're seeing here is the author of Hebrews showing us that these men of faith, though not perfect, kept their eyes on him who is unseen.
You know, one could argue that he was not afraid of the anger of the king because he went back to Egypt and faced him.
Yeah, 40 years later. He did. Now,
before the Passover.
Yes, before the Passover.
So that
yes.
proved he was not afraid
yeah,
of that king.
At that time, that's correct. And stood up to him over and over and over yeah. and over again. Went into his presence. Now, here's the next thing. Seeing him who was unseen. Now, if you take this again chronologically, can you think of an event in Moses' life that comes after he left Egypt the first time and before the Passover that could be described as seeing him who was unseen?
The burning bush.
And some people take this to be a phrase of a description of that. And I'm not saying it's not, but what I'm saying is more than that, we ought to see this as a reflection of what he's told us faith is, conviction of things not seen. So it might point to that, but it doesn't say by faith he saw him who is unseen, as he would if he was describing the burning of the bush as an example of faith. He's not using this, in other words, as an example of faith. He's using it as a description of what faith is, seeing him who is not seen. He endured seeing him who is not seen. He didn't get called seeing him who is not seen. He endured seeing him who is not seen. And then by faith, of course, he kept the Passover and its instructions and how it was to be carried out in order to be saved from the angel of death. We then move on to the corporate faith of the Israelites. And we're given two instances of that, verses 29 following. By faith, they. Now notice that we're not told who they are, but we know who they are because we know the story, just as his first readers knew the story. By faith, they passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land. Now, you remember the story of that? Did they seem to be a people of faith before the parting of the sea? Yeah, yeah. And yet again, another example of the author of Hebrews showing us that faith is never perfect. But faith did. They did, despite their fear of what was going on, they did obey and go through this sea departed. Now, picture this. You've got this sea that's departed, high walls of water on either side. Who's going to be the first to go through? But they did. They showed their faith passing through. It may have been a weak faith, but it was a faith. They did so. And the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned, pointing out that the rightness of having some hesitation there. And then by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled 7 days. Picture this. You're a people. You're not really an army. You're a people. And you're told, go walk around the walls of this city 7 times and you'll get the city. And yet they did it. And so again, an example of faith. And then finally, perhaps the most surprising example that he uses in all of this, even more surprising than Jephthah, the most surprising example in all of these is verse 31. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she welcomed the spies in peace. Now, Rahab is a good example of faith, seeing that Yahweh was not just real, as we were told before, that he is, and he is the rewarder of those who have faith in him. She has faith in seeing that Yahweh is real, that his promises are certain. She's already seen evidences. She knows about the parting of the sea, and she knows about what they've done to the two kings over on the other side of the Jordan. She identifies, rather than with her people in Jericho, with the people of God, turning from her own. She is still identified as Rahab the harlot or the prostitute. And this tells us that, you know, neither our past demerit nor any current merit is what makes us or allows us to persevere as part of God's people. It is always and only faith from the grace of God that allows us to do that. So though she may always be Rahab the prostitute, she is an example of faith for us. You know, other people had sort of a similar fate, and that is Matthew will always be Matthew the tax collector. Simon will always be Simon the zealot, even though that does not describe who they were in Christ Jesus. But that's just the way it is.
And poor Thomas.
Thomas the doubter. Or the two-faced one, Thomas Didymus. But anyway, she was saved by faith, we're told, because of that. Now, he moves on into the period of the judges. From the judges to the kingdom. And here he begins with a rhetorical question, but he changes all of the by faiths of individuals. And let's read verses, just one verse, verse 32. And what shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets. And then we'll go on in a minute and see what he describes about them. Notice how he uses the rhetorical question. He's done this over and over and over again. Again, it shows us his skill as a writer. This time, he tells us something a little bit more, I think. Time will fail me if I tell of. Now, we don't see this in our language, that is the English language, but in the original Greek, the me here is the first person, singular, me, if they tell me, modified by a participle, telling, here seen as a condition, if I tell. Now, participles don't just have, they don't just have their tense, they don't just have their mood, but they also have a masculine or feminine or neuter characteristic, and this participle happens to be a masculine one. So if me is masculine, what does that tell us about the author of Hebrews? He's a man. So we can put to rest this idea that it was Priscilla. Remember we talked about that at the very beginning? I still have a brother-in-law, PCUSA minister, who says that Priscilla wrote this, but he needs to study his Greek a little bit more. But anyway, here we have some judges introduced to us, and they are introduced in non-chronological order. I don't know if that's of significance or not, but perhaps some of their exploits will be referred to in just a minute. But from the Judges, he moves on to David, the only example of a king he mentions, and Samuel. And again, non-chronological. Should be Judges, Samuel, David. Because we have in the first Judges, in the second David, the king, and then we have the bridge between the two of them. Samuel was the last of the Judges. He was also the first of the prophets. And so then, and the prophets, we see this tying in role that Samuel has between these. Examples he gives of this are divided into examples of the victors of, in faith and examples of the victims in faith. Now, what I want us to do is see if we can conjure up any that people we know from the Old Testament or the times before Christ that fit some of these descriptions. First of all, they conquered kingdoms and performed acts of justice. My version says righteousness. Probably justice is better there. And that would point to people such as whom? One that he's already named.
Judges.
Well, some of the judges, yes, they conquered kingdoms, formed acts of justice. David was described as a man who did that sort of thing. They obtained promises. Well, again, judges did that. Kings did that. Here we go. They shut the mouths of lions. All right. Daniel's one, but are there other examples that have already been named?
Samson.
Yeah, he did. He shut the mouth of lion.
David did too.
Remember when he told Saul before he was going out to eat Goliath? You know, when the lions came, I grabbed him by the mane and killed him. They shut the mouths of lion, quenched the power of fire. Anybody remember Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah?
Yeah.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, that being there and being the most likely thing that he's mentioning there, what does that tell us about the shut the mouths of lions most likely represents? Daniel. Yeah. And I think that's context there gives us that. Escape the edge of the sword. That can be a lot of different people. We know that David was escaped the edge of Saul's sword. Elijah was attacked by the men of Jezebel to kill him by the sword. Elisha by King Jehoram. Jeremiah, we're told, was put in prison. He was chained up, and he was to be killed with a sword. So he fits not only that, but also escape the edge of the sword, the sword, and the mention of the king, imprisonment and chains down further on. From weakness we're made strong. Anything come to mind?
Samson
is a good example of that. So is Gideon.
David
is that. You remember Gideon started with 32,000 and was reduced to how many? From strong he became weak. No? But from weakness of the 300, he conquered the people. Yeah. Became mighty in war. That applies to law and put foreign armies to flight. Here, women receive back their dead by resurrection. Two examples.
Ezekiel?
No.
Elijah.
And the widow of Zarephath and his successor,
Elisha,
and the Shunammite woman. So we have two examples of that there. And others, here are the victims now of faith. Others were tortured, not accepting their release so that they might obtain a better resurrection. Now we're getting into most likely the intertestamental period. Understand that the author of Hebrews in his Bible had those books we call the Apocrypha as part of it. So here when he's talking about those who were tortured, not accepting their release, in other words, they were tortured unless they gave up their faith, but they wouldn't give up their faith in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. And almost every commentator relates this back to a story of a mother and seven sons who were put to death sequentially by Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus IV, because they wouldn't renounce their faith and they each described the resurrection that they were looking forward to. Others experienced mockings and scourging, same kind of thing, chains and imprisonment, were stoned. Now, the interesting thing here is that if we go by Hebrew tradition, Jeremiah not only was imprisoned, not only threatened with a sword, he was chained, and he, not in the scriptures, but by tradition in the Hebrew literature, was stoned to death. They were sawn in two. Isaiah, in Hebrew tradition, was sawn in two because when the king, and I'm trying to remember which king it was Manasseh. Now, not Manasseh, the brother of Ephraim, but the wicked king Manasseh. He threatened to kill Isaiah. Isaiah ran and hid in a cedar tree. Now, this isn't a scripture now. This is tradition. Ran and hid in a cedar tree. And so Manasseh sent his people out to him. They cut down the tree, brought him back, and cut him in two just like they did the tree. That's the tradition that we're seeing here. And probably because it's such a well-known story with them, that's the story that it's talking about. They were tempted. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins, goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, wandering in deserts, mountains, caves, holes in the ground. Those are all descriptions of the prophets and the way that they lived their lives. I do want to tell you about one other example that is commonly mentioned here, and again comes from the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, and that is this idea of being tempted. Antiochus Epiphanes went to a 90-year-old priest by the name of Eleazar and tempted him to make him the high priest if he would renounce his faith and be released from any torture. He refused to do so. So Antiochus had him stretched out on a rack like a drum, and then they beat him like a drum until he died. And so that was the temptation that many people relate to what the author of Hebrews is talking about here. These various other examples, Calvin is described in this way, are used in this way to cause us to think deeply. If those on whom the great light of grace had not yet shone showed such surprising constancy in bearing their ills, what effect ought the full glory of the gospel to have on us? A tiny spark of light led them to heaven, but now that the Sun of Righteousness shines on us, what excuse shall we offer if we still cling to the earth? Finally, verses 39 and 40, and all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised, because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. God, the author of Hebrews is saying, has provided something better for us than he did them, because he's given us the fulfillment of those promises. And this takes us back to his prologue, where after having spoken in various ways in times past through our father, to our fathers, now in these last days he has spoken to us in a son. So that something better for us has been there from the very beginning of the book of Hebrews. They would not be made perfect. Those people, these saints, these people of faith that have been described in chapter 11, they would not be made perfect. And remember what that means in Hebrews is their consciences cleansed by the blood of Christ. They would not be made perfect in any other way than we are. They're made perfect by their consciences being cleansed by the blood of Christ, just like we are, so that they and we together would have unrestricted access to the presence of God through Christ. And this is a description of that process, or the progress of redemption that we see from Old Testament to New Testament. Now, think on this. If Christ's return is delayed, and we go to be with him before he comes, those who come after us will look upon us in the same way as us not obtaining the things that are promised any different, or being made perfect any differently than they will be in their faith at the time of his coming. So this progress of redemption is something that the author of Hebrews is painting for us here. And As he moves on into chapter 12, we will come to that other verse that's very well known to us. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, laying aside every encumbrance, that is, the easily entangling sin, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer perfecter of the faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. That's how he really concludes chapter 11. But that's where we will take up next time and when we come back together. Let's pray.
Yes. Steve, I'm reading it all. 2 Corinthians 4:17.